Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health.
There is a moment that so many mums experience where you've sent emails, you've attended meetings, you've been calm, you've been collaborative, but nothing changes. Then suddenly a suspension, a safety incident, a formal complaint. Then suddenly everything moves. And then it feels like it's almost too quick and it's out of control. And today we are unpacking why that happens within the school system. What schools respond to, what they don't, how to approach them, what works, what doesn't in practical reality. I have brought in Sarah Hocking, who is an educational disability advocate who works directly with families navigating school-based discrimination, failed adjustments and escalation processes. She understands not just what should happen, but what actually moves systems in everyday life. Sarah, I'm really glad that you're here. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when Sarah arrived, I immediately let her know that I'd ordered sushi and we were going to be having lunch together. But she said she wasn't sure if she would have the energy to because she's been very busy this morning advocating at a school. Is that right?
Oh, busy. This week, every day, I think I've had 2 to 3 school meetings.
Wow. And Sarah, for reference, is located on the Sunshine Coast, Queensland, clearly because she's here with me and I'm offering her lunch to stay and talk to me. But do you think that kind of quantity of work is the same everywhere?
I think it is. I have clients across Australia. I think it's a systemic issue.
And Sarah, you're not Australian sounding from your American accent. But how long have you lived here and how familiar are you with the Australian system?
I have been here for 10 years. I worked in the Australian school system for 3 and very quickly ascertained the state of the system, not just the school I was at. I had 3 contracts at 3 different schools in very different settings and saw the same problems chronically.
I spoke to someone in America recently about their system. And I was wondering what your thoughts were in terms of the American education system and the Australian.
I have a lot. That could be a whole episode in and of itself. Here's what I like about the American system. 1, if you have a problem with the school, you can sue the school and go to court and resolve the issue. It's not a federal court issue. You're not having to go through 8,000 steps of a Department of Ed complaints process. You do your due diligence. You contact a lawyer. You sue the school. Issue resolved. Do I think everyone should sue? No, that is wild, but it resolves the issues and schools are worried about getting sued. There is no recourse in Australia other than going to federal court. And who has money for that? No one.
I'm just going to go in hard into a side crest because I can't control myself. Last year, I hired a lawyer and I did say, I believe that this is now a foreseeable risk, what my son is experiencing. And I believe that it's a failure if you continue to have that environment run the same way and he continues to be harmed. Did I ever intend to really sue the school? No, but nothing was fucking working. And that actually did move them. So I thought we could.
You can, but the process is much harder and it's more complex because of the way the Australian court system is set up. It's a different system to America. I like that the American system has less gray area in their legislation around special education laws. So kids have to be in the least restrictive environment based on their demonstrated need. There's all different potentials that exist within the American system that aren't here.
So more flexibility, basically. Okay, well, that's very interesting. In our last Making School Work series, I had 700 mums write in on a jot form with their experiences. The stuff that people have written and the audio in on the school system and questions that people want answered are shocking. I'm sure that you hear them all the time. A mum wrote in about her high school teen.
School just says to my teenage daughter, you'll be right, when she's dysregulated. Incidents like refusing to go to class or becoming unwell mentally are never reported to me. She spends a full day in meltdown or shutdown and I'm never contacted until I pick her up and I find out she's been like that for 3 weeks. The accommodation is not involved or shut out. The school says they can't implement proactive daily supports. And if it doesn't work, then we have to leave. My teenager wants to stay, but I know it's not working. I don't know what to do. Homeschooling is not an option. At what point does being reasonable not work because I keep asking and I feel that I'm being ignored?
Is that just like every day for you? Like, oh yeah, that's just a Tuesday.
This is a Tuesday. This is the third message on a Tuesday.
Holy shit. Okay. Well, there we go. Well, this episode is going to answer that question. If it doesn't specifically, we're going to come back around, right?
Yep.
So
Do you think that there is a moment in your advocacy work where you have realized that being calm, collaborative, and reasonable just doesn't shift anything?
This happens on a regular basis to me. And this is happening regularly in schools to the point where I approach school meetings as if they're going to be hostile and unwilling to collaborate. So that way I'm not surprised when it happens. Because at first it was catching me off guard and I was like, hang on, what's happening? And I might be sitting there in a meeting with a parent and my job is not co-regulation, but I do come as a co-regulation person with a parent. So they're not just on their own sort of thrown to the wolves. And then I'm trying to sort my nervous system out because I'm like, whoa, this is not what I was expecting. I was expecting a conversation, a collaborative process, and we're not met with that regularly. That's the exception, not the rule.
This is how I feel. I'm so glad you said that because I feel like in the meetings that I have, I basically set up legals. It's like I'm preparing for them to fail at anything I'm asking them to do. I'm expecting there to be more incidents, and I'm expecting that at some point I'm going to have to review all the dates and the times with what we've said and how it didn't work and how now we're in the same situation or worse again. And I thought that was just me being a negative Nancy.
No, this is the norm. God, I go through so many emails. I comb through behavior incidents when we can get copies of them, even though all parents have a right to any documents that their kids have at school.
This is what kills me. I have been waiting for incident reports for 6 months. I haven't received them from anywhere. And I've ended up going to Freedom of Information.
Right.
Because that's the only way forward. Yeah. Because it does feel like you ask for them. I'm up to like 12 times. You just don't get them. And it's ridiculous.
It is because you have a legal right to access those documents.
Exactly.
And anyways, you just get stonewalled.
In your experience, what do you think schools actually respond to?
I've found it depends on the school personnel. It depends on their capacity, understanding, knowledge around disability, around the legislative requirements that they're obligated to follow, like the Disability Discrimination Act, the Disability Standards and Education Act. Largely, I work with Education Queensland families. It's the largest proportion of students whose families I'm supporting. The people inside the system don't seem to know their own policies. And so when I'm talking to them about their policies or citing bits of policy, they look at me like I've pulled something out of a hat that is like some American thing, and I'm talking to them about something that doesn't apply. So it's much harder to find a rational pathway forward when people who you're trying to talk to are in like a whole different world.
Yes. So my six-year-old got punched in the ear by a 12-year-old who's like, he's hitting puberty. He's a massive 12-year-old. And they iced it and walked around with him. He was incredibly upset. I work from home 5 minutes away. They didn't call me. I've got a photographic memory with legislation, right? I don't even know how many sugars I have in a coffee, right? But I can tell you the legislation. I said, hang on. If you apply first aid, and it's a head injury particularly, do you not have a requirement to do an incident report and to call me and give me the opportunity to get my son checked? And it was like I was asking for them to do CPR and do an operation there. Thought it was bizarre. This is the third school we've been at. I know that's the case, but they like think it's bizarre. And so now I get text messages like, blah, 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 fell over in Gracie's knee. And I'm like, hey, so can I ask? Because a 12-year-old punched my 6-year-old son in the head. And now I'm getting texts about the grazing of the knee as if I'm the problem. But they don't seem to know their own legislation, exactly what you said.
And that's why I think it's hard to have answer your question directly and say, this is the pathway forward. Because there isn't one. The people who do understand that, and there are a few schools I work with who do, very few, they are good about bringing in regional support and good regional teams and the appropriate people from region. And by that, I mean, not just, oh, we have the principal advisor for autism here because your child has autism. That person is not always the most appropriate person to liaise with. They're also quite good about talking to external stakeholders. They'll have stakeholder meetings, and if they're not being reasonable, they'll take these considerations in, and then they'll start to implement things. Those are the people who know. 80% plus of the people, nobody knows what they should be doing.
Because just this week, the principal asked me to have a stakeholder meeting with the principal inclusion head, right? And I was trying to figure out, is that the big gun that's going to tell me verbally
you know, like give it to me? Or is that somebody who they brought in to actually help us? I did not know.
Good question. It also depends on that person's relationship with the school and the personnel at the school. I found that some of the regional people seem to be friends with the staff at the school.
I've heard that too.
And then they just back the staff at the school no matter what they say.
This is what I was worried about.
And in some cases, no, they're really lovely. I have worked with some really lovely principal advisors who know what they're doing. They know what their role is. They understand what the school is doing, what the school should be doing. And then they liaise with the school to help them behind the scenes. They're not telling any parents what they're doing and how they're working. But I've seen them upskill school staff, and I've seen it be quite helpful and quite beneficial. So that is something of the strategy. I ask for them to either make a referral to region, or I ask if they have made a referral to region to get that ball rolling, even just to get anyone else outside of the school into the school to get eyes on from a different perspective.
And this is interesting, isn't it? Because when you come in defensive or paranoid or feeling like people are out to get you, let's just say, I feel like that. You know what I feel like? But, you know, when they do offer, we'll bring an external in to help us, I immediately get paranoid thinking they're bringing in some lawyer from Big Gun, like that's going to come. And I'm trying to hold them to calling me for first aid, doing proper incident reports. And I was expecting they were going to be bringing in the lawyer to tell me about what they couldn't do. And so I didn't know where to even go or not. Like these externals, how do you know?
You don't. It's a dice roll until you get into the meeting, which is why I say to parents a lot of times, one, if they're already working with me, don't go to the meeting without me. And I go on Teams, like I can't drive everywhere. And so I'm on Teams meetings a lot. And I often will suggest to the parents to only meet via Teams if they feel that the meeting will be adversarial, or if they feel like the school might try to say something before or after our team's official meeting, because it's very easy to make sort of side comments or ask questions before they click connect or let me into the meeting, whatever the team's thing is, and then have small talk at the end, or the parent really feels trapped in and back against the wall.
It is great to have a face-to-face meeting because maybe you do work collaboratively. Let's be positive. But the other side of it is that if it's a verbal meeting and someone says, well, this is what you said, and that's not what happened, and obviously there's different perspectives, but how do you even control meeting notes?
Yeah, good question. I always take my own by hand. Anything unhinged that the school says, I put in quotation marks and I quote it verbatim, which is also why I suggest parents take someone with them. It doesn't have to be me, even if it's like their friend, their partner, their mom, to take notes. And then someone at the school should be taking notes for meetings. And I ask for a copy of the notes at the end of the meeting, or ensure that meeting notes will be sent out to everyone. One school I noticed, the teacher was taking notes and she left the meeting because she had to go do playground duty or whatever. And no one at the meeting started taking notes. So I just kept taking my notes, asked for their notes at the end, and they were missing 5 pages of information. Then I had to type up and say, can you please add these to the notes? This information seems to be missing.
Wow. Well, I have never had a school ever take notes. I'm always the one that sends them and writes them. There's never any notes at all. I've never seen notes.
That is wild, because schools have, within one school, they have to document contacts. So they should be documenting every text message they're sending about Gray's knees. They should be documenting any phone calls. It doesn't have to be a verbatim document, just a summary even of what the exchange was. They need to put any emails they send into it. And there is a character limit, but they can put a Word document on as an attachment. So they could capture a stakeholder meeting, a case management meeting as note, put it into one school, and then there's full documentation. They're liable for their own notes. If they're not doing it, who's to say the meeting happened? You can just say, no, I didn't come to a meeting.
Exactly, right?
And how do they prove it occurred?
Does my hitting. Okay. So
I did not answer your question. How do you do this when they're being unreasonable?
Well, the question was, what do they actually respond to? And we basically don't know.
Because it's different every time with every school. It's different if there's a new head of inclusion, if there's a new deputy. The school may respond differently just based on the change in personnel.
And then What do we know that schools ignore?
Because I'm always about picking a battle, right? If I pick every battle, it's ridiculous and I don't get hurt.
Yeah.
So what do schools ignore anyway?
Very emotive, long emails, voicemails, attempts to have phone calls. Even if you are feeling quite emotional, I would suggest waiting. Wait 24 hours, wait 48 hours if you need to, unless it's like emergency situation to address it. Because schools will basically put you in the too hard basket and put you into the she's a psycho basket and not be willing to entertain what you have to say. They do not like questions around reasonable adjustments, which is the legislative terminology. And then they're just mad because we provide reasonable adjustments. We go above and beyond, but they don't understand the legal threshold for reasonable adjustments.
And so what is that? I mean, we have to ask that question.
It's massive. It's not well defined because there isn't case law to back up what that threshold is. There are Australian Human Rights Commission, Queensland Human Rights Commission. It's so high. Like schools need to spend millions in capital addressing access needs before it becomes too much. That's just for capital adjustments. And the threshold for the one case that I have found case law about, that I have read, and essentially it looks like there were disability standards for education act violations, but the child was putting the safety of the school at risk because of their behavior and the threshold that it was reaching. But there were all these steps that the school needed to do first before that threshold was met. And so it's not a clear cut, you have to do this, this, and this. The law reads undue burden and unjustifiable hardship.
From their perspective or the child's?
From the school, in terms of what the school has to do, as long as it doesn't put an undue burden on the school or pose an unjustifiable hardship to the school, the school has to put that adjustment in place.
Okay. And what would be like an undue hardship, like having to shadow someone one-to-one every moment of the day? Is that like an undue hardship? Or?
No, because that's provided for under the NCCD, the school funding model, extensive funding.
This is so laughable because I was trying to imagine what an undue hardship was because, you know, even if you just say, can I get one little thing? It's like, oh no, we can't do that.
Yeah. Asking to put in a therapy pool because your kid needs aquatic therapy at school.
So it's pretty out there. Just because, you know, when you're asking for like, can my child go for a walk, you know, once a day for half a second if he wants to? And it's like, no, we can't do that. So I was just trying to figure out what an undue hardship would be.
It's like, pretty big to an extent that the funding model is set up because it does have allowances for things like one-to-one support. And if kids are in the extensive category, that's the highest category they can be in. It means they need one-to-one support always,
always.
And the school system for primary school gets something. This is not going to individual schools before anyone freaks out. This goes to the department. It's something like 235% loading on the 13,500 that the school gets per pupil.
Just one second. I interviewed Ren and we were talking about NCCD adjustments and behavior, right? And I'll put the link to that in the show notes. How much does the school actually receive versus the education system?
Good question. It depends. All my answers seem to be it depends. Depends if it's a private school, an independent school, a state school. If it's a state school or a private school like CAFED has like their whole CAFED network, the funding goes into those bodies. Those bodies determine how much funding trickles down to the school. Ed Queensland has the wildest spreadsheet I've ever seen in my life. They plug in total number of students, how many kids they have at each of the NCCD levels. They would plug in Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders, kids in care, kids. There's a couple other factors that attract extra money for the school. They put that into the spreadsheet. They get a number, like a fractional percentage, of how many full-time teachers they'll get, about how much guidance officer time they're allocated, how much speechy time they're allocated. And then let's say they're allocated 4 teachers, but they only want to hire 3. Use one of the teaching positions to fund more guidance officer time, more speechy time, more teacher aid time. They can do that. So schools don't even know directly how much funding they're getting a lot of the time, because the spreadsheet is so convoluted and doesn't give them baseline dollar amounts, which I feel for principals because it does make it hard for them to hire people or know what they can spend money on before those funding allocations hit their account.
So then if it's trickled down into the schools, which makes sense from what I've practically experienced, because I was thinking that that big bucket can't be in the school because they seem really legitimate. They just can't do it, right? So where does it sit then within the education department somewhere?
So it goes to the federal funding, goes to the state education department, and it sits in there. And if you, this is probably a whole separate podcast, but if we were to look at what is happening in America, in Britain, here, New Zealand, the Western society, we would see the same thing happening in schools and any institutional systems. They're becoming more top-heavy, and then they're fragmenting. And what has worked isn't working. So they're focusing on these micro concepts like attendance or reasonable adjustments and becoming attached to these very small aspects of school and losing sight of the big picture.
Well, this is it in a tick box.
So yeah, that's what it is. But this is going to continue happening because of the civilization, Western society trends that we're in. We're in a downward trend where the systems are collapsing and where new systems are emerging. So that is playing into what's happening and why so much funding is staying at the state level and not making it into schools.
So are they doing the corporate thing, like tick the box, defend the system? Because they're not doing PD. The teachers, from what I understand, are screaming for PD.
Yeah.
They want it.
Yeah.
So that's out there, isn't it? It's really sad.
It's really sad. And I tell my teacher friends to leave, which sounds terrible because they're really good teachers. But just to save their sanity, I tend to spot patterns and trends a little bit before other people might. And so I got out because I was like, this is going
in a place that I don't want to go with it. Yeah.
Yep. And the ship is sinking. I can't be a part of this. And I think that's what happens too. You have good people who know what they're doing, who have high skill levels, where the work situation becomes untenable for them, because the rest of the department around them is in shambles and they can't continue doing that. And we know in any sort of big office setting, if you're good at your job, you get more work. And the people who aren't continue to have less work.
And I suppose they're also maybe more aware, where some other people are more like, I'm just going to turn up every day and do the bare minimum and,
yep,
and leave. Those people that are leaving are the ones you want to keep.
Which makes it hard to try to address this at the school level. It makes it hard to try to take your complaint to region. It makes it hard to try to escalate complaints from there, because we, I'm not saying this is where we're at this point in time, but as the systems collapse, you end up with the lower skilled workers and mediocre skilled workers who are trying to manage these things that they might not even understand, which we see in other government systems, people working outside of their scope.
Yeah. Oh, it's... I was kind of hoping talking to you, maybe I was being too... You're kind of confirming.
And I think that's what's so important. I say this to parents all the time. It's not a you problem. This isn't you being unreasonable. This isn't you as the problem at the school. This is a systemic problem that can't be addressed. There isn't a fix. The fix is doing our own thing, starting homeschooling pods, starting micro schools, starting independent schools, and having options to break away from the system that's burning down.
It is burning. You mentioned Titanic earlier. It definitely seems like that. So if we go back a step, a lot of the listeners that sent in questions were talking about how the school says we legitimately cannot implement any daily adjustment or even the smallest things. The parent has the impression that they actually can't. And I've had that happen as well, where you have somebody like, I actually would love to do that for your child and seven others that need it. I'm so sorry, we actually can't. And when you're looking someone in the eye, I'm like, I actually believe them. Is that just resources? What is it?
This is a sticky answer, because at the end of the day, I'm a teacher. I support teachers. I support schools, and I want them to thrive. But the problem is people are lacking the skills, like in the training, like in the competencies to understand what to do and how to do it. So even things like when I was teaching in an inclusion role, I took my breaks, not when the kids had break and lunch. I took it the first 30 minutes back of middle session, or I took it right after afternoon session. I'm still having lunch. I actually was eating while I was doing other stuff, but only because I was starving, but I was allocated a break time still. I did that because there were kids who needed support at break time who I needed to support. That was the level of support they needed. And so I shifted my timetable. Schools don't see that as an option. They don't consider it as an option. They don't seem to want to do that. And it's a very simple strategy that is effective. And so I see a lot of situations like that where there are completely reasonable adjustments, like going for a walk. I had another parent ask the school that. The school bordered on some kind of a paddock that had horses in it. It would have been really regulating just for this boy to walk down, see the horses, even if they're not up at the fence, and walk back. No, that's not possible. That is a school choice to not put reasonable adjustments in place because that is reasonable and they can do that. So on some level, I don't know that it's on the teacher level. It might be on the school administration level. They're saying no. This is so interesting because late last year, I ended up advocating with the school very heavily and I stopped doing that. So I was like, I got nothing left. I'm so worn out. And one of the things that got to me, I actually don't think I slept for 3 days because I was so frustrated. And it was around exactly what you said with problem solving reasonable adjustments. So there's two kids. One of them was mine and they were having some difficulty, to say the least, playing together or being around each other. Very explosive situation. And I asked for them to be separated, which I felt was fair, right? So we can't tell the other child they can't play, right? Even though he's the instigator, right? But we can't tell him he can't play because they both need to have equal access. So my kids use soccer as a social support. I have lots of evidence, right? That's basically one of his only goals is soccer, friendships, right? So I get the letter and I'm like, he can't have his soccer time taken. It's the only way he will get to school, right? And it's not fair. And that's the only way he has any contact with his friends. They said, no, the other child must have the same access. So there's two breaks. And they said one child can play at one break and one can play at the other. Now, the other child doesn't really care so much whether he plays or not. He's got other interests, right? So he didn't seem too concerned. My son was heartbroken. Like it was like his arm had been cut off, right? And which is why I got the letter for this particular reason. So the letter was, I don't know if it was not read, ignored, and they continued to take off exactly opposite to the recommendations. He got so upset that I just thought, I just don't care. I'm that mum already. Everyone knows I'm a fucking pain in the ass up there. I don't care. I'm just going to go in because this is not okay. And I said, hang on a second, you're going against recommendations, blah, 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 right? Said the things. They said that wouldn't be fair because they both need to have equal access. And I ended up having to actually explain what inclusion was. It is not about two kids having the same access exactly. It is about children getting what they need. My son, not because his mother said, because his clinical psychologist said, needs this. Why cannot the two boys play on the same team? I'm not saying he can't be there. I'm saying, why can we not have them on the same team? Why can we not have supervision? Why can't we have a smaller game? Why can't we have things where they can pass to each other only? Did my head in that they thought inclusion was everyone having the same thing and that I was saying that the other kid couldn't play soccer? That's basically what you're saying.
This is 100% the norm.
Really, at the heart of it, the system's the problem, right?
Yes.
So we don't want to turn on each other. We don't want the school's advocates, the parents and the teachers to be at each other. We need to all point out where it is, and that's the system. That's because the system isn't supporting them to understand.
Yes. But that's what happens when they're pointing at the system and they're asking for help and they're not getting help. Yeah. They feel like they're constantly under attack and like they can never do enough. They don't have enough time. They don't have enough access to resources. But I think too, that goes back to this downward trend in collapsing systems.
Okay. Let's circle back around to the listener question because it was a cracker. And I get so many people that want to have help with teenagers particularly. Would you like me to reread her question?
I'll have it in my brain. I would start to ask questions. That seems to be how I get traction at schools when I can get traction. I also ask questions that I know the answer to so that effectively, this is a little bit mean, but it's the only way I found that works. I ask questions I know the answer to. When they don't give me the answer that I know is the appropriate, correct answer.
Let's give an example. Let's just say you're the advocate or you're the mum. What questions would you ask that you know the answer to?
For this one, I would want to look at her personal learning record, her learning plan, and see what adjustments are in place. Then go to the meeting and say, notice this in here. Is this something that we can do? Knowing it's reasonable, they should be answering yes, and I'm happy to offer examples to them
for how to do that. And if they say no, then I start asking more questions, sort of backing them into the corner to where they see themselves, and you can see it across their eyes once they realize what's happened, that it sounds insane if they say no. Okay, you have this well-being hub. I often position it as, I don't know how your school runs. Please give me more information. Do you have teacher aides in there all of the time? Do you have support workers in there? Do you have a behavior team? How is that staffed? How do the kids access it? I'm writing notes, taking down what they're saying. Then I say, could she access the room? How long can she stay there? What's the protocol for her to do that? Does she get a little, I need a break card, hand it to her teacher and walk out? What are the steps?
This is a good one, right? So I did that at the school in a way. And I asked, well, what is your supervision like at lunchtime and at the breaks? How does it work? If you have these three areas, how many teachers do you have? Trying to figure out how we could get these two boys to play so then no one gets hurt and they both play, right? And I couldn't get the information. They wouldn't share to me. So they can't do it, but yet you don't know how it runs. So I'm kind of caught between, like, am I being unreasonable by asking that it could be run in a different way? But then in the back of my mind, I'm going, I don't know how invested they are in creating this working, right? Like, I'm invested, I'm the mom. But how invested are they? I don't know.
I think that's the core problem. And it gets at what the mom who wrote in about this is asking. And I see this a lot in high schools. They are not invested in supporting the kids based on their level of need. They're invested in kids who can come in, get a little bit of support in whatever model they have set up at the school, and manage in that model and can pass their classes. Seem to not have an interest in changing supports or doing anything outside of the box. And look at those kids like, maybe they need to do homeschool. Maybe they need to do distance ed. Maybe they need to go into like a flexi school type setting. And because there are those at the high school level, most families self-exit and go to those options because high school is untenable.
If we were to finish up this episode, which is around asking nicely, working collaboratively, being very reasonable, when do you think enough is enough? If a mum is listening and thinking to myself, am I being reasonable? When should I escalate? When do you know as a mum that you've asked reasonably enough times and you need to try something different?
If you're asking that question to yourself, you're already past the threshold. You have thought about everything in the middle of the night while you're awake from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m., laying there unable to go back to sleep, and run through all the scenarios 5 nights in a row in a different order, in a different way. You've expended all your options if that's the question that you're at. I think it's a good thing to make complaints to region, not because I think they'll be resolved, but because it creates a data set. It creates a data set around complaints. It gives you a pathway to escalate from there, and it shows the systemic problems that exist. So if third parties are looking at that information, they're saying, oh, this is a problem, especially at the school level. This school had 57 complaints of Disability Standards for Education Act violations. And when I write complaints, I list out what policies have been violated, where the kids' rights essentially have been violated, and I'm very crystal clear about that. And I set up complaints. This might help parents write their complaints. I do a brief history of what has happened. I write about what the violations are and steps that we would like to resolve the complaint. Every time. That's my format
of it. Well, if you would love to know more about Sarah, we're going to put her website into the show notes and all of her information. Sarah is going to be back next week. I'm very excited. And we are going to be doing an episode following on from this. So this is all about what you can be reasonable asking about. And the next episode is going to be like, reasonable time's finished. We're taking it up a notch. I'm very excited. And we will do that next week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jane.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD mum's shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.